Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Delmarie Cobb, Tim Krolaitis, and Doug O'Brien. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. Well, tonight we will be talking for most of the program this evening about reaction. We're one of the first national radio shows to give you an opportunity to react to the verdict out of Sanford, Florida yesterday that George Zimmerman was found not guilty in the case involving Trayvon Martin. A lot of people on both sides of this issue want to sound off and offer their assessment and reaction to this, and that's what our broadcast will be this evening. One of those who did respond was the President of the United States in a statement issued this afternoon. This is what President Obama had to say. Quote, "The death of Trayvon Martin was a tragedy, not just for his family, for any one community, but for America. I know this case has elicited strong passions, and in the wake of the verdict, I know those passions may be running even higher. But we are a nation of laws, and the jury has spoken. I now ask every American to respect the call for calm reflection from two parents who lost their young son. And as we do, we should ask ourselves if we're doing all we can to widen the circle of compassion and understanding in our own communities." The president continues, "We should ask ourselves if we're doing all we can to stem the tide of gun violence that claims too many lives across this country on a daily basis. We should ask ourselves as individuals and as a society, how can we prevent future tragedies like this? As citizens, that's a job for all of us. That's the way to honor Trayvon Martin." Okay, let's begin. What can we learn from this? What can we say? What can we do? How should we react so something like this does not happen again? Anthony Anderson, we'll start with you.
My personal point of view was, as in 2012, I thought that the president should have stayed out of this whole thing with Trayvon Martin. At that point, it became highly politicized, and at which point, again, you had Zimmerman didn't do himself any favors by going on to Sean Hannity at the time that he came out. I realize it was for, you know, trying to raise money for his defense, but neither one helped the cause. I mean, there's no difference between what happened in Florida, in Sanford, Florida, than what happens in Chicago on a daily basis. There's a murder that happens on a consistent basis in Chicago. There's not this much precedence or this much information is given to anyone on any given basis.
Delmarie Cobb also joins us. Delmarie, what can we learn from this tragedy?
Well, there was a difference, and the difference was the fact that had the public not gotten involved in this case, Zimmerman, it would have gone unmentioned. It would have gone unnoticed. And that's what the difference is that the public forced the system to put Zimmerman on trial.
Did the system, however, work in that that they perhaps were forced into moving a case to trial that maybe was not ready? Tim Krolaitis, your reaction?
Yeah, I think the media and I think a lot of politicians did a disservice and drove this thing into the courtroom. I think basically the local enforcement agency did its job, and unfortunately politics got involved. President Obama, just like you mentioned earlier, the statement, and he just can't help himself. When I was listening to his statement that you read, it was wonderful, 80% through, and he just has to throw that little political caveat on gun control in there. He just doesn't learn.
Doug O'Brien is our other Republican this evening. Doug, your reaction.
Well, I think that the point being that it really wasn't the public that drove this into the courtroom. It was the pundits who drove this into the courtroom. And to Anthony's point, you know, we every single day in Chicago, we see a running total of gun violence, of murders, of shootings. And those are really tearing apart neighborhoods. Those are destroying neighborhoods and families on a day-to-day basis. But we never seem to have the earnest attention being paid to that was paid to this one case.
When you say the public, I want to come back to sort of, you know, the public drove it. I mean, Del Marie, wouldn't you acknowledge that within the specific public, the civil rights community, the leadership all over the nation, they gravitated to this particular story. That was a black man who had been killed by a white man, Hispanic white man with the name Zimmerman. And that the racial aspect of this, that's what turned on the media. And so the media was a willing a vehicle, if you will, for the civil rights community to make a big case out of this tragedy.
Well, listen, I agree with everything everyone is saying in terms of what happens here in Chicago. There are little boys being killed every day in Chicago by people who look just like them. But the public did drive this in that when it first came to my attention was through petitions online. That's when it first came to my attention. And that's what I saw just like today. There are over 400,000 signatures already calling for the judiciary to investigate this, the Justice Department to investigate this. It was that kind of public outcry. And what the difference is,
let her finish.
And the difference is we knew who had shot him. And nothing had happened. In the case,
tremendous amount had happened. It was investigated thoroughly by the local authorities. A grand jury was convened and investigated, and they were not going to charge. That is our criminal justice system.
And to that point, the Justice Department just announced today that they had been looking into this case for about a year now as to whether or not they were there were charges that were merited from a civil standpoint. Now, let's let law enforcement do law enforcement and the criminal justice do the criminal justice system. If you look at it, if you take a look, it took law enforcement almost 40 days to bring charges against Zimmerman. Why? Because they knew we would end up in a situation where we ended up Friday in a not guilty verdict. Let law enforcement do law enforcement's job, not the public and not politicians.
But would you acknowledge that in that community and in some communities around the United States, there is a lack of trust in local law enforcement as to whether or not they are aggressively pursuing a story? And the one aspect of what you said I absolutely agree with. It seems to me that during this trial or during any trial, there needs to be a greater education done by the media, not fanning the flames of racial tension.
Absolutely.
But educating those who watch this on television, who may have watched 40% or 50 or 60 or 80% of the case on television, which is a very small number of people. But the six people who made this decision, they listened to every word every day. And those six people know more than every single commentator, regardless of what side they're on all the networks who've been yapping about this for over a year. Those six people watched every single word and every single piece of testimony. And again, we have to respect them as well. 1-800-723-8029 is our phone number. We want reaction from everyone this evening, wherever you're listening from coast to coast. The verdict in the George Zimmerman case, not guilty. Do you agree with that? And also, most importantly, what can we learn from this so that so it doesn't happen again? Are there things to be learned? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. During the break, I was making a comment about the responsibility of the news media. I think in this particular case, this is yet another example that the news media tends to be cheerleading for one side over the other. They try to be fair when the verdict comes out, but they've already, I think, played their hand in a case like this. And also, it really frustrates me. Granted, this story broke, on Saturdays when a lot of people were off for the weekend, so a lot of people had to scramble and put things back together again. But I just wish that when you had a high-visibility case like this, the major, certainly the 24-hour news operations, I wish they had one single reporter that sat in like the jury and was there every single day to hear every piece of testimony and that when it gets time to have the instant analysis of what's happening, I wish there was a real live person, that each network had someone there who could literally talk about and explain to the public why the jury might have gone in a particular direction. There isn't that type of knowledge by most of the people who are thrown on the air of the 24 hours. They're offering opinion. They're offering speculation. They're going off news clips that they may have seen. They don't deal with the specificity that something of this importance should warrant. And that's a frustration that I would have of the news media in this case and in other high visibility cases.
In addition to that, Bruce, what I would also say is no one's named the actual place of residence to maintain their culpability in this incident also, because here you have an incident took place on your property and you have an armed man with absolutely no training to speak of walking around with a loaded weapon and essentially hunting people down, for lack of a better term. And now how is the relationship between him and the subdivision or the homeowners association culpable in this situation? I mean, this would have been a perfect opportunity by the media to shine some light on Florida's concealed carry laws or to shine some light on the stand your ground laws. Maybe they could have refreshed those laws a little bit, because now you have a person, like I said, that hasn't even been trained to carry a loaded weapon. Now he's going around shooting individuals. Now, where do you think the lawsuit is going to fall at this point? On Mr. Zimmerman, who has no money, or the homeowners association, who's going to be totally culpable in this situation?
Does everyone at this table agree that any opportunity for George Zimmerman to have a peaceful life is over? Del Marie, would you agree with that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned,
he's not going to prison.
As far as I'm concerned, he shouldn't have a peaceful life.
Why not?
Because what happened did not have to happen, regardless of the verdict. And I don't have a problem with the verdict. The judicial system worked, and I'm okay with that, as long as we had a trial. That's what I wanted to see. We had the trial. I'm not happy with the outcome, but it worked. But the bottom line is,
you want him to be persecuted for the rest of his life?
He should be. I don't want him persecuted, but he should never have a day of rest, however that plays out, whether it's in his mind, whether it's publicly. I don't care how it plays out, because the parents of Trayvon Martin will never have a day of rest.
That's a far cry. That's a far cry from respecting a verdict.
And this is an incident that did not have to happen. Regardless of where you fall on this, it did not have to happen.
That is a far cry from respecting a verdict. You're talking about vengeance. You want
I'm not
a man
talking about vengeance.
Will you let me say, you are talking about wanting a man to suffer for the rest of his life. That's not respecting a verdict. That's not respecting the rule of law. That's revenge. That's a mob mentality.
I am not talking
and
about
that is
vengeance.
Exactly the problem that we're dealing with here.
I said whether it's peace
now,
of mind,
man,
I don't care what
you said
in what
he should
form
never have a
takes.
Day of peace. You said whether he should never have a day of peace.
And I said whether it's peace of mind.
Now, any
so
person,
that is not vengeance.
Any person who, if you so in that sense, the soldier who has taken a life, anybody who has taken a life in any circumstances, whether it is found
is
to have been justified.
A
jury, a court of law, found that what happened was not illegal. That's the justification here. What you're doing is setting yourself up as an alternative jury, and you wish to sentence him to a lifetime of torment.
Do we have a situation here where the vast majority of the people that are interested in this story, discussing this story, they're operating in the court of public opinion? Everything is admissible in the court of public opinion. But I get back to the responsibility of the news media to explain to the public how our judicial system works, and that it's important that when you have witnesses and you explain to the witnesses that those witnesses, when they tell their story, they are being judged not only by what they say but by the way they say it, and that the one lead witness that the prosecution thought was going to be a plus for them turned out to be someone that was not a plus for them. Miss Gentel, she did not play well with those six people. Would you acknowledge that?
Oh, I agree with you.
Okay. So, but the public has got to understand that when they put the same thing with the calls, when he is when when uh, when the comments of George Zimmerman are played, and when the comments of Trayvon Martin, allegedly the comments depicted by Janelle, referring to him as a greasy-ass cracker.
Creepy.
That those are words that rile people up as well. But I would ask everyone, I want to get everybody's reaction to this. Of all the things that you read about, heard about, or saw, was there anything that happened in that trial that surprised you, that was really a learning moment for you, Tim?
As far as the trial, no. As far as the way it was handled, yes. I mean, when you have news organizations like NBC editing audio tape to get a rise out of people listening to it and leaving out things where they talk about, you know, they ask, was he Hispanic, was he white? No, he's a black male. Well, they edited out the question.
Right.
What is that about? And we have to ask ourselves, is our media doing its job? What is a white Hispanic?
They'll pay for that in court.
Does anybody know what a white Hispanic is? Does that make our president a white African American? Because this is the funnel in which our media is operating, and it's not good.
Doug, in the trial, what was the one thing that surprised you most on either side of the case that you learned just by following the story in the media?
To me, it was the surprising lack of substantial evidence that the prosecution walked into court with. Because when you listen to the evidence that they presented in their prosecution, while I cannot look into the heart of George Zimmerman nor the heart of Trayvon Martin and say exactly what happened at that time and place, unlike so many other Americans who seem to think that they can see clearly and know exactly what happened. But in a courtroom, you've got to present substantial evidence. You've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think it's unfortunate that I think the state attorney in Florida felt pressured to go into a courtroom with less than optimal evidence to convict.
So did the Republican governor.
No, absolutely. Everybody was scrambling to try to be on the right side of this case.
The one thing that surprised me the most was the fact that when it was pretty evident that the evidence that they had on Mr. Zimmerman was thin at best, when the prosecution had requested Mr. Zimmerman be charged also with child abuse in regards to this murder here, I was like, well, they're grasping at straws now. It's obvious that they can see that the case is slipping through their fingers, and they're going to try to get this guy with something. If it's nothing but something that can get him in jail for a long time.
Do you believe it was widespread knowledge before the trial that came out in the trial? Do you believe, Del Marie, that the average person or the casual person interested in the story knew that George Zimmerman had been punched in the face, his nose broken, and his face bashed against the cement?
Did the average person know
that?
I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't know that. It was in the articles.
Is that germane to the story, in your view?
I mean, it's germane that Trayvon Martin tried to defend himself, because the bottom line is somebody was following him. He's a 17-year-old. What about him standing his ground? He was a 17-year-old and somebody was following him at 7 o'clock at night when he was on the phone with nothing in his hand but a bag of Skittles and an Arizona iced tea.
Is that a germane point, Anthony?
Well, it really is.
It's 7 o'clock at night. He's 17 years old. Is it germane that when people start following you as a young black man,
mm-hmm.
were you followed? Have you been followed?
Absolutely.
Have you ever felt that same fear that he might have felt?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's you have a point there, but still, to the point where I'm going to initially strike this individual, to the point where I'm feeling that my life is threatened. I mean, that to me
but
seems a little bit
the,
out,
but
out
that's
of
the part we don't know. That is the part we don't know. The mm-hmm. part between mm-hmm. him pursuing him and what happened after that is really the part we don't know.
Well, we do
and
know
so
now
I'm
that
say-
he was found not guilty
no,
of doing something to, of that,
well,
it's of
no,
that nature.
What, the, what it is, it's like,
absolutely right.
It's like Raul, Rodriguez in Texas. Raul Rodriguez in Texas. When he went after his neighbors because they were playing their music too loud, and he was invoking the stand your ground law. The difference is, in these two cases, is that he was videotaping his own aggression. So he's going to go over to these neighbors' houses. He's going to approach them and provoke them. And then he's going to say, I'm in fear of my life. I'm in fear of my life. I'm in fear of my life, thinking that this is a way to prevent him from being prosecuted, or if, in fact, he pulls a gun. The difference is we saw what happened on tape. What we don't know is what happened between Trayvon being followed and Trayvon turning and defending himself.
Trayvon was...
We're gonna pause. I'm going to let you answer that, but we do have to go to break. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, we have a full board of lights. We will go to them from coast to coast and border to border when Beyond the Beltway continues from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our guest this evening, Delmarie Cobb, is here. She is president of her own public relations firm called the Publicity Works. And also she's been a longtime talk show host and very active in the Chicago political scene for many, many years. Anthony Anderson also joins us. He is the founder of the Republican Precinct Project in Illinois. Also professionally, he works for the Illinois criminal justice system, where he has been in the juvenile justice system for 20 years as a member of the administration, also a former Marine veteran from the west side or south side of Chicago?
West side of Chicago.
West side of Chicago. Tim Krolaitis also joins us. He is a Tea Party leader in the state of Illinois. He is the chairman of the Will County Tea Party and also active in Republican politics as well. Doug O'Brien also joins us. Once upon a time, he was chief of staff to Congressman Mark Kirk, and he is now the president of the Prairie Strategies, which is a Republican, not exclusively, but more Republican public affairs. And you take some money. Would you take some money from Democrats if they pay?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. You're bipartisan in that respect. We have lots of callers on the line, and we're going to try to get as many callers as we possibly can. Let's go to Temple, Texas, where Kevin is listening to us tonight on KLBJ. We begin our conversation in the state of Texas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. One, it was a correct verdict. Two, it never should have been brought to trial. Three, the fact that Trayvon Martin's supporters are now comparing this verdict to what happened to Michael Vick explains that they don't understand that there are laws, and part of the law is a right to self-defense. This was never a stand-your-ground case. This was always a self-defense case. And the jury did an excellent job, because as a prosecutor myself, I understand what they were doing, because they were in there for a while, and they came back and asked the question about, okay, well, give us the definition of manslaughter. What are we talking about? So they obviously had already ruled out murder. Then they went back, and they went through manslaughter. And first of all, if you remember, they asked for all the evidence. So they were methodically going through everything. I was afraid myself that they were going to come back with manslaughter, because there was so much pressure on them to charge him with something. But they did an excellent job. And by the way, I am black. I'm not white. This case was political from the very beginning. They should have let the police and the officials in Sanford do their jobs, which they tried to do, but the public would not let them.
Kevin, let me ask you a question, because you've identified yourself as a former prosecutor. Was that a federal or at the state level?
State, and I am still a prosecutor.
Okay, here's my question. Can you explain to the audience why there were only six jurors?
That is a peculiarity, apparently, of Florida law, because I was surprised at that myself. This would certainly be a felony case in Texas, which would mean you would have 12 jurors. I don't know why a murder case in Florida, it has six jurors. That didn't make any sense to me either.
Okay. Now, you've identified yourself as a prosecutor. You've identified yourself as a black man. My question to you is, for those parents of 17-year-old black men today, what advice would you give them in the wake of this trial and verdict?
I would advise them to counsel their sons not to become wannabe thugs, not to go out and punch people in the face and then beat them while they're on the ground and expect nothing to happen. sometimes you meet somebody who's going to give it back to you. That's what these people are all full of tears and outrage when these people, when their children go out and do these things to people and they get what's coming to them, really. But where are they when these people are growing up, when their children are growing up and they're vandalizing, they're getting expelled out of school, they're doing all these things that are leading up to serious crime.
But that was not the case with Trayvon Martin. But I want to ask, thank you for your response. I want to ask Adele Marie the same question. What message would you give to 17-year-old black men in America today?
You know, that's a case-by-case basis. I mean, you hear parents saying that they are counseling their sons not to talk back to police, to not put their hands in their pockets when they're in stores, all those things. I mean, you tell your kids all of those things. I had a nephew who, he's a grown man now, but of course he went through being 17, and he would come here to Chicago and spend summers ever since he was 4 years old. And every time he came to Chicago, because he's from Cincinnati, it wasn't as dangerous there as it is here. And we counseled him when he went out to make sure that he didn't get in trouble. And there were many times when he was harassed by police, but that we know he wasn't doing anything.
So that's good advice. That is still good advice.
Oh, you have to tell. I mean, as a black boy, you have to give them special things. You tell them in terms of life-saving things, and these are good black boys. I'm not talking about those who are thugs.
All right, well, Anthony Anderson. Let me. I want you to respond to the same question, but let me put it in context for those people listening around the country. You were in the juvenile justice system. You worked there as an administrator. You've been there for a long time, and you deal with juveniles. You deal with young men.
Absolutely.
What advice would you give them? Not the ones that you deal with on a daily basis. And then I know you want to elaborate on that answer.
One thing I would tell them first and foremost is, you know, make sure you get an education first of all. Secondly, you need to know what you're doing, when you're doing it, and how you're doing it at all times, and make yourself aware of what the laws are. Now, it's one thing to say, okay, I didn't know what I was doing was wrong, but it's another thing to know what you was doing is wrong and continue to do that behavior. You know, I've been in Department of Corrections, DOC, DJJ for the last 20 years, and in all my time there, every individual that walked through those prison doors, before they came there, they've been arrested at least 10 to 15 times before they walk through a prison door. Now, you have young male juveniles in this state of Illinois that keep up so much commotion in the streets of Chicago, in the suburbs of Chicago. And I'm not saying everybody does it, but you have these same individuals who constantly prey on individuals in their own community as if they were young terrorists.
Tim, a question to you. Because part of this is about profiling, about whether or not George Zimmerman felt uncomfortable with Trayvon Martin because he was 17 years old and, again, not necessarily a kid, but certainly a young man. So my question to you is, and I'm not asking you to speak for the entire Caucasian race, but, again, in your sphere of influence, do you understand why some white people are very, very concerned and upset and get nervous when they're around 17-year-old black men?
I do, to some extent. But on the other hand, I just want to make a point. You say, what will we do? What will we tell young black youth about this? That was a question you asked. Mm-hmm. There's a 17-year-old child dying, black, white, Hispanic, Chinese. I don't care what they are. This is an awful tragedy. So we have to put that there. When we talk about thugs, we can't assume, and unfortunately there's some on the Zimmerman side of the argument that says, well, this is a young thug that got what he deserved. We can't assume that, as much as we can't make the assumption that George Zimmerman went out there with his gun toting, looking to take care of his neighborhood watch program with this guy. So I'll give you an example. I traveled the Midwest for business. Okay, I travel different states. I got Illinois plates. I get pulled over because people are seeing Illinois plates in some of the areas that I'm in. It probably happened about 5 times this year. Okay, what do I do? Do I get a group together and then we go to other states and say, hey, listen, I've been profiled as an Illinoisan, which I don't blame with the state of our state. They probably don't want us coming to theirs. But, you know, there's a bigger issue and a bigger narrative going on, and unfortunately it's playing out in this case, and it's not fair to the Martin family, and it's not fair to the Zimmerman family.
Doug, what's your answer? Answer the same question. Advice.
Well, I think that everybody raising a child needs to raise those children to, as Anthony said, obviously education is foremost, but to respect their community, respect the rule of law, and respect their fellow citizens. And I think that really that's the basis of really the way we can avoid these situations. But Tim makes a very good point. None of us can look into the heart of even George Zimmerman. We certainly can't look into the heart of Trayvon Martin. And it is tragic that a young man lost his life. But I think what is equally tragic is that there seem to be an abundance of people from coast to coast who claim omniscience, who can state beyond a reasonable doubt that they know exactly what happened on that night and they know exactly what should happen. What we do know is that the case came to trial and a jury was presented with evidence and the jury found that George Zimmerman had not broken the law. Now, everything else beyond that, anybody who seems to think that they know exactly what happened is part of the problem and not part of the solution.
If you have someone, you know, one aspect of this, which I think is an important part to discuss, is if you are someone who joins a neighborhood watch, is your personality and your makeup tend to be more aggressive than people who do not?
I don't.
Is there something in the personality? Also, when the police told him, basically, don't get out of your car, and he chose to do it, and that it seems to me, was basically flying in the face of what authority had told him to do.
Well, I think it's hard. It's hard to judge in a situation like that. This was obviously a very distressing moment, certainly for him, a tragic moment, and your judgment is skewed. But I don't think we should paint with a broad brush people who care about and care about their community, people who volunteer to protect their homes and their families. I don't think it makes them aggressive. I don't think it makes them negative in some way. In my community, in Chicago, we've been told by the police, be vigilant. When you hear things, when you see things in your alley, when you hear things in your neighborhood, pick up the phone and call the police and do it.
That Mr. Zimmerman had called 911 over 40 to 50 times in this little neighborhood watch thing he had going on, and he had almost been commended by the Sanford Police Department for doing so.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Lots more calls. You'll hear them all when we come back from Chicago.
Cared with his cell phone.
He did many times.
He cared with his cell phone, and this is what happened. He got pummeled on the ground.
During the break, we had a great discussion, and I was just going to let it roll because Delmarie, you made the point. What has George Zimmerman learned? And then during that discussion, then Doug, you said you wouldn't want George Zimmerman in your neighborhood. And then Tim started standing up. So what's your reservation about George Zimmerman?
Well, what I was
found not guilty.
What I was saying was based upon the facts that we know George Zimmerman was an individual who chose, as a neighborhood watch member, chose to go through his neighborhood on patrol, so to speak, with a loaded weapon. And I think that, to Anthony's previous point, I only want people out there with a weapon enforcing the laws and patrolling the neighborhoods who have had the appropriate training and, better yet, who are sworn officers. I think neighborhood watch members are very valuable, but their most valuable tool is a cell phone. Trayvon did use it, but it needed to stop there.
My point, Bruce, is that, one, Zimmerman was told to stay in his car. He had every right to make the call. I make calls. I don't go out and try to take the law into my hands. He could have stayed in his car. If he thought that Trayvon looked suspicious, then follow him in your car. See which direction he went in, and when the police came, point to where you think he went. That's the way it could have been dealt with. Instead, Trayvon did not go into Zimmerman's car and pull him out. We're acting as though somehow Trayvon started all of this. Instead, what started all of this is that Zimmerman did not do what the authorities told him to do, which was to stay in his car. They appreciated the call, but they gave him instructions, and he chose to ignore them.
And you were concerned about what Doug had said, Tim.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a symptom of the bigger problem, and I think we just saw it here. We can't project into these people that we know something because we saw a case. When you said you wouldn't want him, Zimmerman, living in your neighborhood, well, how can we say that? How can I say, just as easy as I could say, well, I wouldn't want this hoodie-wearing thug walking through my neighborhood with Skittles? I mean, that's the problem. We're actually arguing a civil rights perceptions that we all have, and we're myopically putting them into this case, and we're not arguing the case. That's what those six jurors were for. They came through with a verdict, and we should respect that verdict. Now,
Tim,
if you want to argue
not,
the
that's
other,
that's not what I
well,
said.
No, I'm
that's
talking to General Knight. Well, but if we want to talk about those things, which I do believe there's an issue, then we should talk about it, but not in the context of this case.
Well, I want to get back. Well, you know what? We're going to take calls because we've been waiting a long time. Craig, listening to us in Chicago, driving in Chicago on WLS. Go ahead, Craig. You're on the air.
Yeah, my question, I guess, to Del Marie is, if Trayvon would have been white or if George Zimmerman would have been black, would this issue have brought up the national outrage that it did?
You know what? I don't know that many cases where that's been where that's happened.
I mean,
I just have not seen that be the case. Whereas if Trayvon had been white, and Zimmerman was black in a white community, and then Zimmerman, I mean, who are you saying shot who? I mean, because the outrage is that Trayvon was black. Trayvon was black in a predominantly white community.
But I think one of the points, Craig.
What if George was the white Latino like he is, or white Mexican, or whatever they called him, and Trayvon was white, and the same thing happened? Would the black community be as outraged?
You're saying if both of them were white, would blacks have been outraged?
Would the black community be outraged? Because I'll be honest with you.
We would have been outraged in a different way.
But Craig, let me ask you this point. There's somebody, you're calling from Chicago. The black community and the white community in Chicago, I think, are outraged at the number of young, innocent black men and girls, boys and girls,
and you know
kids,
what? As
real
a
life
male,
kids,
I am
killed.
Too.
All right. So my question to you is, where do we go with that outrage? The point is, with all of that carnage that we have in Chicago. Granted, there have been stories, and when someone goes and performs for the President of the United States and then is shot dead 2 weeks later, that becomes a big, big story, as it was in Illinois. But again, there isn't the type of day in, day out national coverage that's covering that. What made this story unique was that one was Hispanic white and the other was black.
But you know what? You just made a statement, Bruce. Yes, all of these young black kids who are being killed in Chicago, and this is not new. We've had the equivalent of a Sandy Hook every year.
Yes.
Every year in this city. And the outrage.
Every month.
Well, every year. I mean, in terms of killings. There was 28 killed last year. Killed.
We probably had 28 people killed in July for a month in Chicago alone.
I'm talking about
children.
I'm talking about. Okay. So where's the outrage around the city? We do not see the same outrage around the city. We see the mayor. He'll have a news conference. He'll come out. He'll march. There's a couple of white faces who are prominent that come out. But I'm talking about the same outrage that we saw for Trayvon. We do not see throughout this entire city.
Well, the fact of the matter is, when the mayor goes into these different
communities, they're all of our children.
Right. Why are you mentioning white faces? Right.
Because I'm saying...
I think I know exactly what
I'm
you're saying.
Here's the problem. We should be more upset
that a young 17-year-old boy lost his life in a tragedy than concerned that it was a black boy.
No, I'm
That's
saying everybody should
and
be
I'm hearing
outraged.
It, and I'm seeing it, and I'm going to call you out on it.
No,
That's the problem.
No, everybody should be outraged when it's a
Well, you're not.
A child.
You're selectively outraged.
No, I'm not selectively outraged.
Well, a child at what age, and what was he doing at the time he was doing it? It's different from
what
a guy who was at Sandy Hook or when he's
What was there to do in that community?
From a gangbanger on the streets, as the police chief pointed out, a lot of these problems in Chicago and around this country are all gang related. Now, there's a certain number that's related to these young kids, but for the most part, all the killings that go on in Chicago, black on black, are gang related.
But that wasn't the case with Trayvon.
That wasn't the case with Trayvon.
We've got to say this group will be back for the next hour. If you're listening to us on radio, if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. And tonight we're featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Del Marie Cobb, Tim Krolaitis, and Doug O'Brien. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. We have a lot of callers on the line. We will go to them right now. We're continuing our discussion of the not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman trial, which has really dominated discussion in the country and probably will for the next couple of weeks. But I want to ask one question, get everyone's reaction before we go to calls. And that is, part of this story is profiling, is George Zimmerman's reaction when he saw a 17-year-old black man that he was uncomfortable with, thought that he might have been suspicious, thought that he might have been up to no good, and it was in the context of a neighborhood where there had been problems in the past. So George Zimmerman had a history, he had a perception. What can we do? And this is, I think, one of the things maybe that the President Obama was talking about is to how can we learn from this experience? What can we do? And I'm going to start with you, Anthony. What can we do? I asked what the message is to 17-year-old black men. What can be done in the white community and the black community to erase some of the fears that exist in all communities when they see a certain type of person walking down the street? It may be the way they dress. It may be the way they talk. It may be the color of their skin. But they want to walk to the other side of the street. They do not want to walk on the same side. What can we do to the people who look like that, talk like that, and unfortunately, a popular culture that tends to perpetuate a lot of that gang thug look?
Well, I think the first thing we could do is have a meaningful dialogue between the two races, mainly blacks and whites, because that seems to be where the problems are stemming from, because there's these, I guess, prejudged notions from both sides where they're coming up with these conclusions that are not necessarily, you know, the case. And they're making decisions based on irrational behavior or irrational thoughts. And so I would say let's start with having dialogue between races. I mean, we need to really sit down and have a gut check about racism in this country.
Delbury, what's your answer to that question?
No, I agree, too. We have not had a sincere discussion, and electing President Barack Obama did not erase racism in this country. And there are many people who want to believe that it suddenly magically disappeared because he was in the White House. In fact, if anything, it's worse now than it was in many cases in the black community than it was when he took office.
In what way?
In that we're losing all kinds of progress. I mean, right and left. There's nobody speaking out. All the other people who used to speak out about things that are happening, you can look right here in Chicago. There's no voice in Chicago. Everybody has been silenced because now you don't need a black voice because you have a black man in the White House.
And to add to that point, Bruce, I would just want to bring up the fact that it's been 2 years to, I guess, yesterday or the day before, where the president has actually spoken with the black caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, in this country.
When you have, let's talk about gangsta rap, let's talk about dress codes, let's talk about cultural things that cause some people, white and black, to be fearful of young black men. What can we do about that? You're 17 years old, you want to rebel. It isn't just within the black community, but people are walking around with their pants halfway down their crack.
Well, you know, Bruce,
and they're wearing their hats sideways, and they're tattooed up. I mean, a lot of people don't want to be in the same room, let alone walk the same streets with those people.
Bruce, this is really not a new phenomenon. What we all have to do is we have to get beyond that knee-jerk categorization of race as a defining factor when you see an individual. But you know, you look back in history, and history can teach us so much, but we keep forgetting it. You look back to things like the Zoot Suit Riots in L.A., because in the Hispanic, the Mexican community, there was a certain type of dress that was prevalent among some of the more problematic elements in the Mexican-American community. And the same thing that we've seen in the Italian-American community. There are people in the Italian-American community who are loath towards those people who sort of glorify that negative stereotype within their own community. And it's unfortunate.
Do they like the idea, Anthony? People that you run into, mm-hmm, in the course of your business are people that have violated the law, mm-hmm, and they're incarcerated.
Right.
Do they like the idea that white people or black people fear them?
Absolutely. I think for the most part, you know, if you look at, you know, historically speaking, blacks have managed to do what the KKK couldn't do in 100 years. There were statistics out there that clearly stated that from 1865 to 1965 with the Voting Rights or Civil Rights Act, there were about 6,000 lynchings or so in the South. You fast forward to the year 2000, you had over 5,000 black-on-black murders in this country, black men against black men. And so you put that in the context, you put the glorification of this rap music, this whole genre where they berate women, they sort of put drug usage and drug sales on this level that no one could ever imagine, and then you put money to that whole thing, then that just blows everybody's away. Every other thing that you had to talk to some young man about, whether it's education, whether it's fearing the law or respecting the law or having a sound respect for the judicial system in this country, all that goes clean out the window if they can look on TV and glorify something that they can be a part of. See, because they can become a part of the whole drug game. They can become part of this whole judicial system. It's easy to get into this whole system.
Is that, Del Marie, is a life of crime viewed now in the black community or sectors of the black community as a way out of their poverty?
I don't know if it's a life of crime, but I agree with Anthony. What it is this whole thing, I can be a rap star. I can be a rap artist. It doesn't take a whole lot to be that, and the money will follow.
You don't need a lot of talent.
No,
is what
right, exactly. I mean, you don't.
And the money will follow. It's
another way out, like being a basketball
star. Exactly.
You know what, Bruce?
Except you can do it. They only have 17 openings a year in basketball. You can have far more openings than that as a rap artist.
Let me just follow, because I think this is important. In those sectors of entertainment, and I will include the NBA as part of the entertainment. In those entertainment where people are paid tens of millions of dollars or more per year to perform, whether they're rap stars or whether they're NBA stars, there is also a propensity of those stars who are held up as heroes, who have children from numerous women, and they let those kids go. Mm-hmm. Does anyone speak up about that? Is there any moral indignation about a lifestyle that treats women and fatherhood in such a cavalier manner?
Well, there are some officials out there. There are some basketball players that do it, you know, as a public service message. But for the most part, it's not done on a large scale. Well,
is it part of the problem?
It is part of the problem. You know, just the other day when the mayor had announced that he wanted some basketball programs for after school, for this, that, and the other, which is good. But I'm like, is that all black people can do is run up and down the court and play basketball or throw a football? Can we get something that there's resources in the community where it has to deal with arts, whether it has to deal with other curriculum that will enrich our lives, or do we have to always stick with basketball?
Got to pause. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Jim in South Elgin, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio, the radio home of Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Good evening, everybody. I think it's a shame that the racial pimps are abusing the system because, you know, Zimmerman had a history of helping black kids with tutoring. If I'm not mistaken, I think he's got some ancestry connections where there's people of color in there. And I just think, you know, you look at all these flash mobs in the city and all these things going on, you know, and like people were saying before, all the murders in Chicago, black on black, and there's not a peep. And there should be a lot more outrage.
Well, there is a peep, sir. There is
well,
a frustration.
Not much of one.
Well, there is a frustration. I mean, again, for those listening around the country, it leads off most of our 10 o'clock newscasts in Chicago. There is a frustration, but again, Del Marie was saying is, what do you do next? And Doug was asking the next question. I mean, for the people that live, you know, for white people that are living on the northwest side of Chicago, that's primarily Lily White, what are they supposed to do, Del Marie? How should people be reacting to this carnage that exists insofar as violence
Chicago? We just need to find out why it exists. I mean, we know that a lot of it is parenting. I mean, we know that that is the core of all of it. But there are also other things that are not in the communities that need to be in the communities to shore up the piece that's missing. I mean, parents, if you got parents who are not completely engaged, because in many cases it's single women households, then there needs to be something to shore that up.
I don't want to say failed. Do the churches need to step up and be more aggressive in being important elements within the black community? I'm trying to think, what is the counterpoint to the black gangster rap culture?
You know, I have said that for years, that the churches needed to step up, because I also have said when the church is the best looking building on the block, there's a problem. But part of the problem, too, is that many of the ministers don't live in the community anymore. They live other places, too. They live in Evanston and other places and come into the community on the weekends. And you're also losing a great population out of the church. You know, the churches aren't filled like they used to be. And they're not filled with community people. People come from all over the city to a church. I mean, we helped to save a church in Bronzeville. And one of the reasons the alderman was ready to let a famous church get torn down is because, in her mind, the people were from 708 area code. And so she didn't care if the church got torn down, because what she was saying is, they don't vote for me anyway.
No, I think.
What's your answer to that? Because we were talking about this during the break, because you were trying to find out what a white person living in a predominantly white neighborhood should do about black on black crime.
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is we have to resist the temptation not to care, and resist the temptation to simply say it is someone else's problem. And the point is that, yes, we have. I think we can all agree there is a family crisis, really a fatherhood crisis in the African American community. And, you know, you hear people say, when I was young, we had nothing, but I didn't need a social worker. Well, you had a nuclear family,
right?
Two parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, everybody living together, taking care of each other. The fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, it doesn't exist now. And I think that one of the things that people in other communities can do is to be, first, engaged and caring, and secondly, supportive of what we can do in the immediate to try to backfill some of those mechanisms that support young people. I think it's one of the best investments we can make in the long term in our society to help those communities that are in need.
I want to ask you, to what extent, when you look at, because Jesse Jackson, although he personally has fallen, in my view, from grace, given the problems that he's had in fathering a child out of wedlock, that was an embarrassment, I think, to Jesse Jackson, the senior, and I think he's lost some moral standing because of it, at least in many sectors. But you have someone in the black community who's spoken about a variety of family values and self-determination, and that's Minister Louis Farrakhan. How successful has he been, in your view, and do you view him as a positive role model within the African-American community, albeit he is a controversial figure?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He's controversial.
To say the least.
But
are you serious?
But wait a minute. But,
like endorsement. A
but wait a minute. But am I, let me, am I right?
Is he that's a stretch and a half, Bruce. I'll say this
is
much.
Wait a minute. Let me finish my point. Is he controversial only with white people, or is he controversial with black people as well?
Well, I think Minister Farrakhan is controversial with mostly all people. It's just the fact of the matter, because he can say some pretty inflammatory things. I am pretty loath to say anything about these civil rights leaders, because, I mean, in their time and at their time, they've done a lot for black folks. I mean, whether it's Jesse Jackson, Farrakhan, and a lot of other these civil rights leaders, or Al Sharpton. I mean, they've done some good, but now it seems as though they're doing more harm than good. And so, you know, I'm really torn, because you can still see some vestiges in the communities on the south side of Chicago or the west side of Chicago, where Jesse Jackson and all these other guys had things in place for those particular communities. And so it's hard for me to get out there and say and criticize these individuals on the basis that they're not doing enough. They are doing something. Now, whether or not I agree with what they're doing is a different story.
Let's go to Houston, Texas, where Carlos is listening to us on the internet. Go ahead, Carlos.
Hey, buddy. I think everybody's missing the point. The point is this. 16 and 17-year-old kids, if you want to call them kids, I call them young adults, are criminals. They have a large criminal group, okay? That is the thing I fear, is 16 and 17-year-olds. And if I'm on a neighborhood watch and I see somebody, black, white, Chinese, 16, 17 years old, you're damn right I'm going to be watching them. And another thing,
Wait a minute, Carlos. Time out. You are not, Carlos, let me just make a point. You just made the point, if they're black, white, or Chinese. Now, you know darn well, if you saw a 16-year-old Chinese student out there, you'd think they were going to the library, right?
If he's dressed like a gangster and he's hanging out at 9 o'clock
like
in
gangsters.
My neighborhood.
They do in Chinatown. There are gangs, violent gangs, that are made up of Asians. There are violent gangs of whites. There are violent gangs of Hispanics and African Americans.
It's not a race issue.
But again, we have to get beyond the simple knee-jerk reaction of race. And when you look at when you see a young person, sometimes, as we talked about, there are those who want to project, and they may be doing it just stupidly. They want to project a tough guy image, but then there are some who are actually problematic, and they can be any color whatsoever.
Del Marie.
But what you said, Bruce, is the fact that there are positive stereotypes and there are negative stereotypes, and you just mentioned it, because Asians have a positive stereotype.
Yes, they do.
Okay. Why is that? My question is, why is that? Why is that? Why is that?
Well, one, I mean, their culture is completely different. I mean, when I'm over in Chinatown, I mean, just the other day, I saw the kids leaving school in a pack. It was about 20 or 30 of them. They're all, you know, single file, leaving school, going to another school, to cram school. And so that's their culture. It's all cultural.
Aren't all stereotypes based on fact?
Yes.
Some element of fact.
Yes,
exactly.
Because I can remember last year when I was just walking around downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue, and it was a pack of young black teenagers. They were 17, 18, T-shirts off, tattoos all over the place, pants down to almost their ankles. And I'm like, are these guys serious? And it's not only one pack of kids. It was two and three packs in downtown Chicago. And you had police all over the place. But it's like, you know what? With that type of behavior, they can be up to nothing but no good. And I'm black and I'm saying it.
Well, Jesse Jackson once said famously that he would walk on the other side of the street if he saw a
Absolutely.
Well, hence our discussion, when earlier you pointed out civil rights leaders. I think the most appalling, who he has become a clown, is Al Sharpton. When he came out on MSNBC and was screaming and yelling, then went down to Florida to draw up a ruckus,
you're probably right in your assumption, but the fact of the matter is, the guy is seen as a pillar in certain communities. So you just can't discount these black leaders. I'm telling you, because in the end, you're going to need these guys.
In the end,
no matter what you
matter,
say,
man.
You're going to need these people those guys are pillars within those communities. And when they say something and they have the people's voices at hand, trust me, if they want it done, it's getting done.
Look what they're saying.
Yeah, okay, well,
I mean,
you want to go convince the other guys that what they're saying is wrong?
Well, all
you're
I think.
Yeah, I'll try my damn best. Yeah, well, that's good luck. Good luck. How's that working for you?
That's what I'm trying to tell them. How's it working?
Right, it ain't.
We have to be vigilant about the double standard, because there are irresponsible things coming from occasionally people like,
Pat Robertson.
Beck, or, well, not so much Pat Robertson, but,
yeah,
you know,
that's a pretty
but Glenn Beck, thing. Glenn Beck, and there are other people on the right who say inflammatory things, and we shouldn't call them all out. Maybe we shouldn't say
that's the problem. That's why everybody's getting away with this nonsense.
Well, I think
if it's wrong, if it's inaccurate, call it out.
I don't think that more invective and more strident and caustic language is going to solve any problem. We have to try to turn and ratchet that down. Whether it's Al Sharpton, whether it's Glenn Beck, whoever it is, we've got to turn that rhetoric down. And we've got to start talking about solutions instead of everybody just simply getting in their trenches and pointing fingers at the other side. This is 1914, neither side is making any progress.
We as a society, and I'm not putting a racial focus on this, we as a society have got to put a stigma back on having children out of wedlock. Once upon a time, that was an embarrassment to the family. It has to be an embarrassment to the family. And the people that keep doing it over and over again shouldn't have their own television shows, their own contracts, be movie stars, be hailed as someone to look up to, when frankly they should
Kanye
be someone
West.
That you pity.
Seriously.
Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Around the table this evening, we have Delmarie Cobb. She is the head of the publicity works, and that is her public relations firm. She's also been very active in politics in the city of Chicago for many, many years. Also, Anthony Anderson joins us. He is with the Republican Precinct Project, and that is a goal to put a Republican precinct committeeman in every precinct in the state of Illinois. Also works in the criminal justice system, the juvenile criminal justice system. That's what he does professionally. And also joining us this evening is Tim Krolaitis. He is active in the Tea Party. He's from Will County. That's in the western suburban area around Chicago. And Doug O'Brien also joins us. He's with Prairie State Strategies, and he is a public affairs consultant with primarily Republican credentials. And joining us now from his home in Atlanta, Georgia, we are welcomed by Lance LaRosso. Lance, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Thank you for having me.
Lance is an attorney, and I got word of Lance's interest in this subject because we're talking about the George Zimmerman trial and the verdict. And Lance LaRosso works with the law enforcement community, and you have some concerns, Lance, about how the law enforcement community should react to the George Zimmerman verdict. And I want to know what concerns you have for those who are in professional law enforcement in the wake of this verdict.
Well, thank you for having me. The book actually is called When Cops Kill, and it's devoted to law enforcement officers to let them know what happens after they actually are forced to use deadly force. And obviously it's a decision that affects them and has long-reaching ramifications, not only in criminal prosecutions, but also in civil cases and how the media handles that. And I think we saw in this case something that's very rare, a very publicized, in fact, televised process through a trial dealing with the use of deadly force and self-defense. We also saw, and this is the biggest ramification for law enforcement, we saw a use of deadly force case that bypassed a grand jury. And that's very concerning because a lot of law enforcement cases are presented to grand juries to allow the grand jury to decide whether or not the use of deadly force was appropriate.
In the case of George Zimmerman, because you have a number of clients who are police officers who've been involved in deadly force cases, and we were suggesting in the last hour of this program what the rest of George Zimmerman's life might be like. Is there anything that you can gather from your experience in dealing with police officers who have taken a life that would indicate what the rest of George Zimmerman's life might be like because of the high visibility nature of the crime that he was involved in, although found not guilty of?
Yes, and let me put that into context. I have several interviews in the book regarding officers who have used deadly force, and some of them even 20 years later in giving me an interview, actually had to take a break because they were still very emotional. I've had clients also who have shot unarmed suspects, and they were justifiable homicides based on the interaction and the force that was being used against them. At least one of those clients has had to leave the state and go work at another department. It was a great loss to the department. It was a lot of training and a lot of experience. But the media attention, including what I term in When Cops Kill, the informal media, which is the blogs and the comments on legitimate news source sites, became overwhelming for his family, and he wound up leaving the state.
Do you, when you, if you will share with the audience, based on what you know of the George Zimmerman case, and I asked this question of our guests in the first portion of the show, as an attorney, what was the most startling thing that you learned from that trial based on the media coverage that surprised you as an attorney, if anything surprised you?
Probably the biggest thing was the fact that George Zimmerman received essentially no credit or leeway or benefit from the fact that he made, I believe it was six, voluntary statements to law enforcement. He had absolutely no obligation to speak to law enforcement whatsoever. The other thing that I think got lost, and this never changed, George Zimmerman fired one shot, and his articulation of why he fired that shot was because he believed that he was going to go unconscious, and he believed, as he said, his head was going to explode, and there were marks consistent with that. But when he fired that shot, he believed he missed. There's two critical analyses in a law enforcement or private citizen use of deadly force. Why did they start shooting, and why did they stop shooting? I talked about why he started shooting. He stopped shooting, in his words, because he said Trayvon Martin put his hands up, said something, but essentially the attack stopped. So he started shooting once, believed he missed, but stopped shooting anyway. And that does not indicate a person who was intent on killing. It indicates a person who was intent on stopping an attack. And that is why law enforcement is trained to shoot to stop the attack. So I think the jury recognized that if he really was intent on causing a life-threatening injury to Trayvon Martin, why would he have stopped shooting? And I think that was a specter that sat over that trial from the first time they heard it.
And as you try to put the piece together, because obviously as a defense attorney, you have to put these pieces together as to, you know, what prompted someone to shoot and what was a life-threatening experience. Again, based on the testimony that you have read or learned or read about, that pivotal moment, because people want to know who was attacking whom. And was there really a life-threatening fear that George Zimmerman had?
Well, sure, and let me just correct you one thing. The only criminal defense I do is representing law enforcement officers in these types of situations. Okay. Most of what I do is civil. Right. It was clear in the law that there really doesn't even have to be an injury for a person to claim self-defense under the statutes, and that's generally the case throughout the United States. What there has to be is a reasonable apprehension and fear of receiving a life-threatening injury. Now, when you put that in the context and overlay the physical evidence that was there, the fact that there were grass and dirt stains on Trayvon Martin's knees, the fact that the responding officer said that the back of George Zimmerman's jacket and the back of his pants were wet, and it was raining that night, the front of him, his pants and jacket were not wet, the injuries to the back of his head, all of those things start to become little pieces of information that lend credibility to the crux of the issue, is whether or not he pulled the trigger when he believed reasonably that he was about to receive a life-threatening injury.
What advice would you give to those people who now everyone in the world has in the United States, has an opinion on this verdict now, even though the only six people that count, really count, are those who were on the jury, who were there listening to every word of every argument. What advice, as an attorney, what advice would you give to those listening to the broadcast this evening as to how they should react and judge future high-visibility trials when they come along? Because they will come along. How should we view, what learning experience can we learn from this as observers of the American criminal justice system, especially when it's under a television microscope?
first and foremost, we have to respect the verdict. I was very concerned, I think a lot of people were concerned, that we would be able to get six people in a jury box who either were impartial or agreed to lay aside any preconceived notions that they had. The pretrial publicity in this case was absolutely pervasive. And I think we have to recognize that as much as people may point to this trial and say, well, you know, it could have been done better, in the three-week period, we had a sequestered jury, and that's probably the best thing we can do to avoid outside influences, and I praise Judge Nelson for doing that. The second thing we had was 50-plus witnesses in a three-week period. That is a tremendous opportunity for both sides to present their side. And then we talked about these 16 hours worth of deliberation. You can believe it. Somebody actually put me when I was practicing law. Put me on a jury after I became a lawyer. I was shocked just as much as anyone else was. But 16 hours of deliberation is not what we saw when we went to the lake or we went to go see a movie and saw, well, they're still deliberating. They sat in a room for 16 hours and looked at each other and the evidence and came to a conclusion. I think we have to respect the process and the outcome.
I thank you very much for offering your assessment, being with us this evening. This is Lance LaRosso. He is an attorney from Atlanta, Georgia. He joins us tonight again professionally. He tends to represent police officers who have been charged in deadly force cases. And one last question to you, because you mentioned that your area of expertise, or you spend a lot of your time insofar as the civil aspect of it. What is likely to happen to George Zimmerman in the civil trial that may or may not move forward, and do you think it will?
Well, that's an excellent question. And when cops kill, we talk a great deal about that, because officers face civil cases sometimes 3 and 4 years down the road after the shooting. They're still dealing with them. There is a provision in Florida law. I looked it up today for one of the reporters that was talking with me based on the comments by Mark O'Mara. The use of deadly force, not just the stand your ground, the use of deadly force justifiably in Florida can be used as an immunity bar to a civil case. In short, the civil case, if it's filed by the family, may be thrown out of court summarily by a civil judge if the judge decides that Mr. Zimmerman is entitled to immunity under Florida law.
Last question. Do you think in high visibility cases like this, what grade would you give the media in informing their audiences about the workings of the American criminal justice system?
I think they get an A for publicizing the trial and being there and having televisions in the courtroom. I'm actually a fan of televisions in the courtroom. Some people disagree. But I think sometimes they did go overboard with talking too much prior to the trial and pushing too many theories that really didn't pan out. 2 years from now, if we ask people what happened in the Zimmerman trial, my concern is they won't remember what the evidence was. They'll remember what they heard or what they read on blogs.
All right, on that note, we say farewell to Lance LaRosso. Thank you very much for joining us from Atlanta, Georgia tonight. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we've got more calls. Everybody wants to jump in on this subject. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head south to Austin, Texas. Alan is listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead, Austin.
Thank you. Question for the panel. If Trayvon Martin had felt his life was in danger, his well-being, that he was being stalked by this menacing individual, why didn't he call 911? And if he called 911, do you think he'd be alive today?
Well, you know, everybody keeps saying that 17 is an adult. I actually don't agree with that, because as my mother used to say when she would get angry, you've only been here 17 summers, what the hell do you know? And so I don't think that calling 911 even entered his mind. That's the difference in a 17-year-old and somebody who's 40 or 50 or 60.
You have a good point. You have a good point. We'll never know, but I think it's a very perceptive question. Let's go to Elkhart, Indiana. BJ is listening to us on WMNC. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Love your top. Well, unfortunate topic, but I love the conversation.
Thank you.
Trayvon was caught burglarizing a car. He was trying to attempt to rape a woman. He was burglarizing a house, so he was shot. No, wait. But he could have done those things because he had that certain look about him. Would you comment on that? And also, talking about racial issues, I mean, since President Obama got into his second term, I live in Indiana. At one time, Indiana had more Klan members than any state in the Union. I'm hearing things like, you can't send a boy to Washington. It's no longer the White House. It's the Black House. The N-word. I don't think I've ever seen things so bad in the state of Indiana as far as racism as has been. And I think President Obama's done a marginally, you know, good job, but better than average. But with Trayvon, he could have raped somebody. So was that why he was shot?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of a rhetorical question, and we don't really
know. I don't
think
it was a serious question.
Now, let's go to Bill in Chilton County, Alabama, listening to us on WAPI, the Blowtorch of the South. Go ahead. Bill, go ahead. Bill, are you there in Alabama? Let's go to Columbia City, Indiana. Oh, oh. Who's that, Bill? Let's go to Ed in Columbia City, Indiana, listening to us on WOWO. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello there. How are you today?
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. You know, it kind of surprised me with Fox how they're supposed to be fair and balanced, and it seems like all they had was people on. I was listening for a couple hours that they were hammering about the injustice done to Trayvon Martin. And I mean, I didn't hear the other side where, okay, you know, it was what it was.
So you thought that Fox was overstepping its bounds?
Well, normally, you know, they'll have both sides, but, I mean, all I was hearing was one side. And
well, that
I'm listening, and I got my back to it, and I could tell that they got colored people on. And it's pushing more towards division than to bring people together.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good observation. Let's go to Dean in Chicago listening to us on WLS. Are you there, Dean? Charlotte in Arlington Heights, are you there? We're running out of our...
Yeah.
Go ahead, Charlotte.
Is anything in this case about drug use, Trayvon Martin... had been using drugs. He was arrested for drug use for theft. In his backpack, they found burglary tools, stolen jewelry. Could that affect aggressive behavior, strange behavior? I know the judge did not allow certain evidence. What was in the autopsy? Was that in his system?
All right. Do you think that can do you think that should have been admissible? If Trayvon Martin had used marijuana, should that have been in the trial? In your view,
are you asking
Charlotte?
Are you asking me?
I'm
reading Investor's Business Daily for Monday. The judge, a lifelong Democrat, did not allow this to come out.
No, but my question to you, if Trayvon Martin had used marijuana but not on the night of this incident, should that have been brought up in trial?
Well, I don't know how long it remains in your system and can affect your behavior. It does cause certain people to be paranoid. Some drugs cause hallucinations. I don't know. Yeah, I think it should be allowed.
What do you think, Anthony?
Well, you know, I'm about to say something. From a color perspective here, I don't think
the last caller.
What color lens are you talking through?
The last caller referred to colored people.
Yeah, I don't think that
it's still called the NAACP.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's why I said it.
Meaning all color.
Yeah,
all color.
It's nice, it's never
purple.
Justification for murder on such a light issue such as it's lack of marijuana uses of marijuana. I mean, you still can't justify killing a person whether you use marijuana the night before, or the day after, or, you know, the day of. I mean,
the early projection of Trayvon Martin by the news media, mm-hmm, and by many within the civil rights leadership, mm-hmm, was that he was this sweet-looking young man. Even the President of the United States said, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
They had way too many baby pictures of Trayvon Martin out there when the story first broke. I'm like, he doesn't look like he's 17. In those pictures that I've seen, he looked like he was like in his early like 10 or 11, maybe even 12 or 13, but he didn't look like a 17-year-old teenager. Even to this day, when the trial, I just seen the end of the trial, they still point out these older, much younger
pictures. We are out of time. Last word, 10 seconds to you.
Well, I think a lot of the drug use and other things about his record, that's not justification for somebody being killed, and they needed to focus on what happened on that street on that night.
On that note, I want to thank Doug O'Brien, Anthony Anderson, Tim Krolaitis, and Del Marie Cobb for their assistance and being with us this evening in a very great discussion. Our thanks also to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in this production, which is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.